Okay, well, I'd like to thank Professor Sahel for an outstanding summary of the field of stem cell research in the eye. I'm Robert McLaren. I'm Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Oxford, another very old university in England. It gives me great pleasure today to talk about the work that we're doing and others have been doing in the world of trying to save eyesight, trying to find treatments for patients who are blind. Usually, the research we do is to try and find treatments for diseases affecting the retina, particularly macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, because these diseases are currently incurable. So, what I'm going to cover in this lecture is I'm going to talk first about the work we're doing with gene therapy to try and correct the genetic defect in the cells before they die. I'm going to give some background to gene therapy using adeno-associated virus, or AAV, as we call it. I'm then going to talk about the trial we're doing in patients with this disease, known as choroideremia. And I'm also going to explain how we're using gene therapy in the lab to do other things, to change the environment of the eye, to stop cells from dying in different ways, and also how we might modify the virus to deliver large genes. In the second part of my lecture, I will talk about the work we're doing with the electronic retina, which is very similar to the stem cells that Professor Sahel has been describing. We put into the eye something which is light sensitive, can sense an image, and send a signal to the retina. We have some wonderful examples of what patients can see with the electronic retina, and it gives us a lot of encouragement to think what might be achievable in future with stem cells. And finally, at the end, I will come back again to talk about the work on stem cells and hopefully put it all together so we can see where we'll be going next. So, gene therapy in the simple form is using a virus to put the DNA into the cells in the eye. The virus we use is called the adeno-associated virus, AAV. It's this shape, it's an icosahedron. It's a very, very small virus. The diameter is about 20 nanometers. It's one of the smallest viruses that we know of. And that is very good because it means the virus can get into lots of places and get into lots of cells. The virus carries inside the gene. This is single-stranded DNA. The virus infects the cell and then the DNA goes into the cell. Okay? We're using the virus to get the DNA into the cell. The virus has two genes of its own. This is called rep gene and cap gene. But what we want to do is we want to take out the viral gene and we want to actually put in our own gene. And we have, within that space there, approximately 4.7 kilobases. Okay? This is the size of DNA we can put in. It's a bit like, you know, a USB stick. A USB stick with 4,700 bytes, it's not big, okay? We can have potentially a USB stick with millions of bytes. And one of the problems with this type of gene therapy is the gene that we put in has to be very small. So we have to think about diseases which we can treat with a small gene. If the disease needs a big gene, we can't use this at the moment. So the concept of gene therapy is to put the gene, the DNA, into the virus, and then that virus infects the cells, the DNA goes into the cells. And the DNA will make protein in those cells, as far as we know, indefinitely in neurons. In other words, for the lifetime of that person. If someone has got a disease, because they're missing a gene in the retina, in the photoreceptors, if you can put the gene back into the photoreceptors using gene therapy, the cells will stay alive and the patient will not go blind and you will never need stem cells in theory. So we have been looking at doing gene therapy in one particular disease that we think is a very good disease, as a good example of using gene therapy to prevent blindness. This disease is called choroideremia, or choroideremie in, I believe, is the correct term in French. The disease has been around for a long time. It was first described by Ludwig Mautner, an Austrian ophthalmologist, in 1872. And there are patients all around the world with this problem, including, of course, in France and every continent that I'm aware of. In Finland, there is a lot of patients with the disease in this area, up in Finland. And we think that there is a founder effect where the gene is concentrated there. So the choroideremia is a disease in which the retina degenerates. This is a patient with choroideremia. You can see that this white area here, this is the nerve, these are the blood vessels, this is the macula, the fovea. The white bit is the sclera. The retina has degenerated, the choroid has degenerated, and we can just see the white coming through of the sclera. This gives the name choroideremia. Now, as you've seen, this is the normal retina that hopefully everyone here in this audience has got. Okay? We have a fovea, optic nerve, nice and healthy. So you can see the difference between the two. Now, one of the good things about the choroideremia is that the gene is missing is 1.9 kb, 1,900 base pairs. So going back to what I said before, this gene will fit into the virus, which makes it a good gene to treat. The gene was identified by Franz Kremers in 1990. So this is relatively short progress, 25 years from identifying the gene to putting the gene back in the cells and correcting the defect. The function of the gene in choroideremia has been determined by my colleague and collaborator Miguel Ciabra, where they realized that the retinal pigment epithelium, which is the cells lining the back of the eye, in the retinal pigment epithelium, the choroideremia protein is needed for moving things around, what we call trafficking. So if you have a situation here with this enzyme, it's called Rab27A geranylgeranyl transferase. This enzyme binds to Rep1, which is the choroideremia protein, and then together this complex adds these lipid prinyl groups to melanosomes, and that helps move these cells around inside the move these vesicles, these little packets around inside the cell. I think it's similar to having a country where maybe the railways, none of the trains run on the railways, maybe like the UK. We don't have nice trains like in France. Gradually, the economy eventually breaks down over time. Okay, and this happens to these cells. The cells die, and the patients then lose their eyesight. So when we make the virus, we need to do the DNA. So I've mentioned about the DNA of the gene. We have the DNA for the choroideremia gene. And if you remember molecular biology, we have a start codon and stop codon. And then we want to have a point where the messenger RNA is translated in the cell, and we call this a ribosome binding site or COSAC consensus. And on top of that, we also need to have other things within the DNA that help switch the gene on and switch the gene off. Okay? Because if we have just the gene, we can't control it. What we have at this end is what's called a promoter. This switches the gene on. And at this end, we have what's called a poly A signal, which switches the gene off, the on and off switches. And this thing here we have called WPRE, this we just put in to make the gene expression higher. Okay? So even though we have 4.7 kilobases, potentially, because we need to include the switches that switch the gene on and switch the gene off and maybe other things to increase the gene expression, we don't have that much space. So this will make messenger RNA, and the messenger RNA will undergo a splicing reaction. We have an intron and an exon here, and then this will remain in the cell with the untranslated regions and this region here, which is making protein. This will remain in the cell, we think, for the lifetime of the individual. Okay? Can you imagine a treatment in medicine as efficient as that? One injection, the disease is corrected at the genetic level for the lifetime of the individual. That's the goal that we're trying to achieve in using gene therapy in the eye. So that's all very interesting from the perspective of the molecular biology, but also we need to think a way of actually injecting the gene into the retina without damaging it. So we do an operation which is known as a vitrectomy, where we remove the jelly from the eye, and then we can inject the virus underneath the retina at the back here. So this operation, vitrectomy, is similar to a cataract operation. It can be done under local anesthetic, but we need to do the surgery very carefully, because if we damage the retina, then the benefits of the gene therapy are lost, because of course the patient will have problems with the eyesight from the surgical damage. So what we do is we have the retina here, the virus gets injected underneath the retina, the viral particles infect the cells, the retinal pigment epithelium, and the photoreceptors. And these cells that are infected are then expressing the protein indefinitely. We have in our trial two groups, a low dose and a high dose, who receive the gene therapy. So what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to show you a very quick news clip from the BBC reporting the results from the first patient to undergo the treatment in our clinic in Oxford.
It could save the sight of tens of thousands of people. Researchers in Oxford are developing a genetic therapy which they hope will stop people going blind. They've treated a man in his 60s who's on the verge of losing his sight. If the new technique works, the gene therapy could transform the lives of many other people in the future, as our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh reports.
Jonathan Wyatt is going blind. He can just about see enough to work from home. But 10 years ago, he was a successful courtroom barrister. He had to abandon his job because he began making mistakes.
The worst occasion, I think, was when I was reading out a statement to the court and I made a mistake. And the judge turned to me and snapped, "Can't you read, Mr. Wyatt?" I then decided it was time to put my wig down and leave advocacy.
Now, have you got any specific questions about what we're going to do?
Jonathan is losing his sight because of a faulty gene. He's the first patient in the world to take part in an experimental operation that aims to replace the faulty gene in his eye with a working one.
What we hope is that by putting the gene back into the cells, we can stop further degeneration and obviously preserve the vision that he already has.
In Jonathan's case, because of a faulty gene, cells at the back of the eye have been dying, leaving only the ones in the middle. Doctors hope to stop further degeneration by injecting new working copies of the faulty gene to keep the remaining cells alive.
Jonathan's operation is just about to begin. There's a little bit of tension in the air because it's an incredibly precise and delicate procedure. One small slip and his retina could tear, and the attempt to save his sight will have failed.
The procedure has never been carried out before. Now, the riskiest part, as the needle is inserted by a foot-operated control. So has the operation been successful?
It went very well indeed. Absolutely no problems.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Yeah, no problems.
One. Jonathan claims he can already see better.
Left.
But it's far too soon to be sure whether there's a real lasting improvement. If it does work, gene therapy could be used to treat a wide variety of sight disorders.
More left.
Pallab Ghosh, BBC News,
right.
Oxford.
So that was the first patient to be treated, Jonathan Wyatt. He gained 4 lines of vision, And we have been following him up now for 4.5 years, and the vision gain that he had has been maintained. Unfortunately, during this time, the eyesight in his other eye has now got very, very, very bad. So because he's the first patient, he's very interesting because we've been following him for some time. Now, we're also looking at other aspects of the gene therapy to make it safer, because the surgery is a very complicated part, and this is an area which potentially could cause damage to the retina. We're looking at things like the thickness of the retina to work out regions of the retina which will stretch more, according to Hooke's law, when we detach it from the back of the eye. And also, we are looking at the volume that we can inject into the subretinal space of the virus without stretching the retina, using basic, simple mathematical models to work out the best way of detaching the retina in each patient and the volume of virus that we can put into each patient. On that basis, we can look at an individual patient like this, and we can identify positions which might be good or bad for doing the gene therapy. One thing we realize, this is the fovea, this is the distance from the fovea. If we inject the virus very close to the fovea, it causes a lot of stretching of the retina, because at this distance, we can only put in 0.1 microliters, which is a tiny volume. As we go further out, we can put in a greater volume of the virus without stretching the retina. And we can put in more than this, but we need to do it slowly and bit by bit so that we don't damage the retina. So that's the mathematical theory. I'm now going to show you the video of this surgery. Here you can see the injection, starting here like a little blister, and here is the fluid going down. This is lifting the retina, detaching the retina. And there's the fluid coming down here. And this is the area we want to get, is the fovea. This is the last bit of vision this patient has just here. And here you can see now the fluid coming here, detaching the retina, detaching the fovea. So that is a nice example of the surgery when it goes well. It's not always as straightforward as that. Here I've got a tube which is sucking, just to show that this hole here in the retina, it's sealed. The needle is so thin that when we take it out, the retina seals. There's no hole there. Okay. So I'm now going to show another clip explaining one of our patients, the most recent patient to have the gene therapy.
Radcliffe Hospital are using pioneering technology to help patients regain their sight. They're using a form of gene therapy to help reverse the damage caused by a rare condition that people are born with. Jerry Wolfenden is one of a handful of people who have had the eye surgery. Victoria Holland explains.
Just saw the camera and there we are, bang. Yeah.
He's described it as a miracle. Jerry Wolfenden has been gradually going blind for 40 years. Once a keen photographer, he's had to give up many of his former hobbies. But now, thanks to new surgery, shapes and colours are becoming clearer and brighter.
Since the operation, actually I can see you. I wouldn't have seen you before. And the other change is colours. I'm now remembering what green looked like. And it is, as far as I'm concerned, a miracle every morning when I look out of the window and I can see all the colours of green and get on with my life. Yes.
So it's very nice with Jerry because he's a photographer. Before in his career, and now he's regained the colours that he had earlier in his life from the gene therapy. And this is another aspect of the gene therapy. It's not just stopping the cells from dying, but it's helping the cells work better, and so these patients experience improvements in things like the vision and the colour. So that's a summary, really, of the whole where we are with the gene therapy and in this particular disease in choroideremia. I'm now going to talk a little bit more about other aspects of gene therapy to slow down or stop retinal degenerations. Now, some of the work that Professor Sahel mentioned was about the degeneration in the back of the eye that occurs in retinitis pigmentosa. The rods and the cones are the two types of cell which are photoreceptors. When you lose the rods, the cones also degenerate. but sometimes it may be due to a genetic defect that is only present in the rods. So in other words, the cones cannot live without the rods. So if we have patients who've lost their rod photoreceptors, it's too late for gene therapy to correct those cells. We have instead the problem of the cones, which is what we use for day vision. These cells will gradually degenerate. So there's a lot of work that's been done here in Paris on the role of oxidative stress and a molecule which is released from rods, which may keep the cones alive by reducing the stress levels in the cones. And I'm not going to go into that in detail, but just to say that we know that there are some patients in whom the foveal area of cones can survive quite a long time and still maintain quite good vision. And if we could somehow find some way of preserving these cones, we would at least give them something. So a lot of work has been done over the last few years, and I'm talking probably going back nearly two decades, looking at a growth factor. And in particular, this growth factor, ciliary neurotrophic factor. And the clinical trial was to put this into a capsule and then to put the capsule into the eye of a patient with retinitis pigmentosa. These cells are genetically modified to make the CNTF. And this protein is then released in the eye continuously and can keep the retina alive, or at least keep the cones alive once the rods have degenerated. This work was led in a clinical trial by Paul Sieving in the USA about 10 years ago. And what was interesting was that they found some interesting results. Some patients gained vision. Others had some toxic effects from the implant. So in other words, it was a story that was quite complicated, because it didn't just help everyone. As I said, some people, the degeneration seemed to get worse, and others, they had improvement. So recently, some of these patients have been looked at using adaptive optics, which is a very detailed way of looking at the retina and counting the photoreceptors, the cone cells, in living people to actually count the cells. And this actually showed, quite interestingly, that the density of the cones in the CNTF-treated eyes appears to be maintained compared to the untreated eyes in this study looking at the counts of the cones. So that's interesting, because we have conflicting evidence that this compound is toxic but also maybe beneficial. And it's useful to consider the possibility that the CNTF may have a different effect on the rods and the cones. And we know that the CNTF has actually got a toxic effect on the rods. So if these cells are surviving, many of them may not work as well. This shows in a mouse model, the CNTF in 6 days after exposure, the loss of the rod outer segments here, which is the control. With cones, however, they respond differently, and they may actually grow and gain outer segments, which is a sign of improved cone health. So we can have a hypothesis that maybe with the CNTF, it's got a beneficial effect on the cones, but a negative effect on the rods. And the question is it possible to get the dose so that we can keep the cones alive, but without making the rods get worse? Okay. Like all medicines, you have a treatment, you have a dose. If the dose is too high, you may have a toxic effect. So to explore this hypothesis, we got a mouse which has got retinitis pigmentosa due to absence of rhodopsin. And in this mouse, the cones are genetically normal because the retinitis pigmentosa is caused by a gene that's only present in the rods. We cross this with a mouse that has fluorescent green cones. Okay, in other words, in the back of the eye, the cones, you can see them, little green dots. And we made a transgenic mouse which had the retinal degeneration but the fluorescent cones. The advantage of that is that when we look at the back of the mouse eye, we can see the cones. Do you see them here? These little dots are the cones. This is the mouse which has got this retinitis pigmentosa. You can see at baseline, and then at week 6, I put a ring round here just to give an example where you can do the cell counts. We can do cell counts between here, 336 cones in here. At week 10, 146 cones. Week 14, 23 cones, and by week 15, all the cones have gone. So this is the same mouse. We don't even anaesthetize. We can just hold it up to the ophthalmoscope, and we can have a look and take a picture and then count the cells. So it's a very sensitive model for looking at this question of the dose. We made a viral vector making the ciliary neurotrophic factor delivered by the AAV virus, which I explained earlier. This makes messenger RNA, which then makes this protein, the CNTF. And we injected this into the eye, so the retina itself is making the CNTF as a result of the gene therapy. And interestingly, by looking at the different doses, we were able to do this, look at the cell counts, and in this particular case, at the high dose, we find that we're keeping the cells alive because the cones are surviving indefinitely. This is quite old for a mouse, 30 weeks. And also, when we looked at the functional tests, we were able to find that the dose that we could get to keep the cones alive was such that it would preserve the visual function without the negative effect of the toxicity. So this is quite a nice picture because this is one mouse, okay? This is the mouse at postnatal week 8, okay? This is the eye that was treated with the CNTF. You can see the retina there, the photo, and then you can see the cones. And this is the other eye in this mouse, which was treated with saline. There is the retina, and there are the cones. If we go to week 30, which is probably late middle age in human terms for a mouse, we can see that in the treated eye, we've got very similar appearing retina, and you can see a large number of cones surviving. But in the untreated eye, there's no cones, and if you look, you can see the changes in the retinal pigment consistent with retinitis pigmentosa. Okay? This is the one eye, and this is the other eye in the same mouse. So this is a dramatic demonstration of potentially using another treatment to try and keep the cells alive, and this would be independent of the gene. The problem is it's difficult because there's also a toxic effect, and which is why we need to know more about this before doing it in clinical trials. So the other question we have is about how to use the adeno-associated virus to deliver the larger genes, because there are not many diseases which we can treat with the 4.7 kilobase gene. This is one. This is a very common condition that most ophthalmologists would be familiar with. This is a disease known as Stargardt disease. And it was mentioned by Professor Sahil in the clinical trial for the retinal pigment epithelium stem cells, the trial led by OCATA, or ACT. So we like this disease because you can identify it quite clearly from these little flecks, and it causes a very early onset form of macular degeneration. It can sometimes cause macular degeneration in children and many other diseases. So here we can see, there is on the fluorescent angiogram, you can see this area here where the pigment is, there is increased fluorescence in these patients from the accumulation of toxic pigment. So this is the single most common form of recessive retinal degeneration. Affects about 1 in 10,000 people. About 2% of the population will carry a mutation of this gene. Obviously you need two mutations because it's recessive to have the disease, but there's quite a high carrier rate. So this would be an ideal disease to treat. We can identify it, it's common. The problem is that the gene that we need to put back in, the ABCA4 gene, is 6.7 kb. So it's just too big to fit into the virus. And also, if you have the other bits as well, there's not much space. The ABCA4 gene, this gene is a big gene with lots of exons. It makes a pump in the retinal, in the photoreceptors, the ABCA4 or ABCR pump, which pumps the visual cycle enzyme, or the retinal, which is the molecule that reacts to light. It pumps it out of the cell for recycling. So you know that when you go into a dark room, it takes a while before the vision increases, the sensitivity increases, what we call dark adaptation, due to the vitamin A being turned around and recharged. The ABCA4 molecule is a very important function for this recharging. So for that reason, most of us just didn't really think about ABCA4 or Stargardt disease as being treatable, and we just ignored it. Except for one example, one of my colleagues, Albert Arrucchio, who is an ophthalmologist in Milan, who works in gene therapy, he published this paper from his group in 2008, showing that they could pack the large ABCA4 gene into the adeno-associated virus type 5. This shows the retina from the mouse. This is a normal mouse showing the ABCA4 protein stained in the outer segments. This is the mouse that is a knockout mouse. It's made without the ABCA4 protein, and this has been injected with a control virus, and this shows no staining of the outer segments of the photoreceptors. And this is a slide showing a mouse treated with gene therapy using the AAV containing the ABCA4. And many of us, myself included, just couldn't believe this because the gene physically is too big to go into the virus. So what happened? And I spoke to him, and he said, oh, they just made it up in the lab, and they made it, and it worked, and fantastic. So it created a lot of interest, and a lot of people then started to think a little bit more about what's going on here, what's the mechanism? And it was subsequently identified that what we're looking at is a phenomenon where the gene is being packaged into the virus in different ways. Okay, so normally we have the DNA, which is a double-stranded DNA, and here we can have, in red I've just put, for example, you know, the genes in the middle, and we make the virus from plasmids, which have double-stranded DNA, but the virus, the AAV, only has one strand, okay, a single strand. So what happens is that during the manufacturing of the virus, the DNA is cut out from the plasmid, and then the DNA is packaged into the virus, and the virus protein forms around the DNA strand, and for every DNA double strand in the plasmid, you get two AAV particles, one with a plus, one with a minus strand. Okay, simple. These viruses go into the cells, they infect the cell, and then once the cell, the virus capsid is taken out, the cell then converts the single strand back to double-stranded DNA, and then the DNA is read. Okay, that's the normal process with the AAV. And what was happening in the wonderful work done in Albert Arrucchio's group was basically the same thing. The DNA was being taken from the plasmid when they're making the virus. The DNA was then packaged into the viral capsids, but the viral capsids could only form a certain amount, and then the bit of DNA that was sticking out was just cleaved. And similarly, the plus strand and the minus strand, the same thing, the capsid forms around, and then this bit just gets cleaved off. So we have two viruses which now contain different bits of DNA. When these viruses infect the cell, the same process happens. The capsids are removed, and then these DNA fragments, however, have got a region here which is complementary, and they recombine, okay? Because you've got plus and the minus strand. And then the cell makes the second strand and recreates a large gene, okay? So this wonderful mechanism existed and explains the experimental result. I always think it's really nice in science where you have a completely unexplainable experimental result, which nevertheless gets published. People think about it, talk about it, and then they work out the mechanism. Okay? All too often, something which is unexplainable never gets published because the reviewers don't think it's real. So this means, of course, that we can then potentially package up to 10 kilobases. We need a region of overlap here, possibly, which would include ABCA4 and other genes as well. And we've been working in this in our lab for the last 5 years, optimizing this, and we still haven't published it yet, but it's getting close. This shows the ABCA4 protein in our recombination strategy. This is the size of the protein in this Western blot. And this shows a mouse, the ABCA4 knockout mouse, with ABCA4 staining in the outer segments following use of the dual vector, two types of the adeno-associated virus carrying the gene in two halves. So I'm hoping that we can use this technology to expand the application of gene therapy to other diseases. So finally, I come to the last bit now, where I'm going to talk about the situation, about trying to restore vision when all the photoreceptors are lost. Once you've lost all of these photoreceptors in retinitis pigmentosa, there's nothing left, there's no cells to target for the gene therapy. The gene therapy is now too late. So what we're doing at the moment is we're doing work with the electronic retina, which is basically the same as photoreceptors, but in an electronic form. And I'm going to show some work from that. The technology has been developed by Eberhard Schrenner, who is a very well-known, accomplished professor of ophthalmology, retired from the University of Tübingen in Germany. He had developed this technology over the last 20 years with his team, and we were very privileged in Oxford to be invited to join them to take part in a multi-center European trial to assess the retinal implant. And I'm also going to show another video clip just from the first patient in the UK who received this retinal implant. This is the team on the day of the surgery. This patient, Mika Terho, became quite famous because he was one of the first patients to test the device. It was put into his eye with a wire hanging out, and they connected the battery and asked him to look and see. And at the time, they didn't really know what was going to happen, but he was able then to read these letters of his name. Okay, so very exciting. So as a result of that initial trial, subsequently, we've now got many centres, of which Oxford is one, implanting the device.
A British man who's been totally blind for many years has had part of his vision restored after surgery to fit a pioneering eye implant. The device, which was fitted behind the retina, has enabled Chris James to perceive light and even some shapes. Our medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh, has more.
For 20 years, Chris James has lived in darkness.
Welcome back, Chris. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much indeed.
Do come and take a seat in this chair for me.
Blind from the disease retinitis pigmentosa. The vision in his left eye before the implant was fitted was non-existent.
No, nothing at all.
He was unable to make out anything, even in the brightest light.
It seems to have a curve.
Now, the same test 6 weeks after his implant was fitted, and he can perceive light and even the outlines of some shapes.
I find it very exciting, really. We know the optic nerve is working, which is the most important thing, otherwise this trial wouldn't be able to go ahead. And it's just a question of now teaching the brain to wake up and interpret what the flashes of light are telling me.
The electronic chip was fitted at the back of the retina in this operation at Oxford Eye Hospital. This surgery is the culmination of years of research here and in Germany, where the implant is made. Up to 12 British patients will have the chip fitted as part of a major trial of this truly innovative technology. The chip, sighted behind the retina, contains 1,500 photosensitive pixels, which send electronic signals direct to the optic nerve and from there to the brain. The implant measures just 3 millimeters square. This X-ray shows the cabling running from the retina to a control unit sighted above the ear.
I think this is an amazing development. Here we're talking about a patient who is completely blind, able to see. We're talking about something that is here and now, not what might be achievable in 5 or 10 years, but what's actually happening now.
Chris James will never be able to drive again. The vision the implant gives is highly limited and fragmented, but it gives real hope to future generations of patients who lose their sight. Fergus Walsh, BBC News.
So the implant itself is got 1,500 pixels on here, and we have to place it at the back of the eye, under the retina. There is no external camera. The light is focused by the cornea, by the lens, onto the chip. This means that we can't use it in patients who've lost the eye or who have a lot of damage to the front of the eye. The positive thing is, though, if you look at a patient with the chip, you wouldn't know they had it. They move their eye around normally. So, This is a position of the chip, again, another patient underneath the fovea, and you can see that the chip needs power supply, and this comes from an induction coil behind the ear. The cables come around underneath and power the chip, because the chip needs to amplify the light signal to stimulate the retina. Now, here in Paris, we're working on another technology where it may be possible to use the light energy to amplify the power and avoid the need for this. This is underneath the skin, but because of all this, it takes quite a long time to do the operation. So I hope no one here is squeamish about eye surgery. I'm going to show part of the operation, what we do to put the chip in. We make some marks on the sclera, and then we can cut a door, and then we can make an incision at the bottom in order to get into the eye, into the subretinal space. This is a guide foil. This guide goes in, and this enables us to find the channel to come under the retina, and then we can use this to slide the chip in and get this in the correct position. We have to make sure that we don't touch the optic nerve, because the optic nerve, we need the optic nerve to take the signals back to the brain. And this is the chip, and here it goes, going underneath the retina, using this blue foil, and it'll come in here. Again, very similar to the gene therapy, the surgery is very important not to damage the retina, because if we damage the retina too much, the signals that the chip gives will not be received by the brain. Okay, and there it is. So that's an animation. I'm now going to show you the real thing. This is the guide foil. This is the little slit here. This is some fluid coming out from the subretinal space. And this is now going into the subretinal space. And this is a view during the surgery. There's the optic nerve. This is the guide foil getting it to the right position. This patient has got these dots from retinitis pigmentosa. Here is the chip. This is now going in against the guide, and we can slowly manipulate it into position. This cable behind, and here you can see there's the chip coming in. It's not quite there yet. It needs to go in a bit further. This cable is from the power supply behind the ear. And there it is, a little bit further. And here, this is the power supply. This connects to the end of the chip. And then once we have the chip in position, we can then take out the guide, and then it will stay in place. So this is another patient describing, it's very nice how she describes when the chip is switched on.
Five weeks after the operation, time to flick the switch on Caroline's microchip eye.
Okay. Now, can you tell me,
flashing,
is there any difference? What, if anything, can you find on the table?
I'm certainly picking up three definite.
Mm-hmm.
No, I thought there was another one. Four.
Good.
Yeah.
When do you see things?
We have this covering the other eye, because obviously we're doing it scientifically. Now, she's in the trial. She's wonderful experience. Her son is actually living in Paris. He's got retinitis pigmentosa, and she wants to do something to help with research to help him. And this technology is still being developed. It's still in the scientific stage. Here is another one.
There's the bridge going across there.
Okay, it's all the implant.
Light up there, and it's lighter there. You've got the bridge going across. That's the building there. And up there. That's the building that goes up there. But it's not a wide bridge, is it?
This is the bridge of size in Oxford. They copied it and built one like it in Venice.
I thought it would be wider than that. That's like an archway.
Anyway, so one has to remember, this lady had no light perception in the eye before the implant, okay? The vision is very crude. We think something like this, possibly, just black and white shadows, and they do much better outside where there's a lot of light and very high contrast. So the results we've had so far with the electronic retina give us great hope for what might be achievable in future, either with this technology or even using stem cells. Another approach which we're looking at, and others, is to try and maybe not use an electronic retina, But is it possible to use gene therapy to modify the cells to make them light sensitive? If the photoreceptors have gone, then these light sensitive cells have gone. Maybe we can make other cells in the retina light sensitive. And this is some work we've been doing with melanopsin, which is a light sensitive protein that's present in the human eye and is light sensitive in the retinal ganglion cells. And we can make a viral vector expressing the melanopsin protein, and these cells then become light sensitive. We need to improve the efficiency of the gene therapy to get high levels of gene expression. And like the team here in Paris, we've been looking at different types of viral vector, modifying the AAV vectors to get much higher levels of expression of the viral protein in the retina. And these are really very high levels of expression. And if we can, of course, make all of the cells light sensitive, maybe we won't need any retinal implant, maybe we won't even need stem cells. Maybe there's enough cells there to create some form of image. So finally, I'm going to come back to where we started almost a couple of hours ago with Professor Sahel and the work on stem cells. This is very much something that is in future. The retina implant is working now in patients, not just the one I've described, but others. It's with us today. The technology works. What we're looking at with improving cells, improving vision with stem cells, is something that's a little bit further in the future. The work that I've been involved with has involved looking at this mouse, the green fluorescent mouse. This was made by taking the gene from the jellyfish, Echeuria victoria. They have some of these in the marina in Barcelona, if ever you go there. And the scientists in Japan in the 1990s, they took the gene out that make the fluorescent protein, and then they put that gene into the mouse genome, and then they made the mouse that was fluorescent green. And the scientists that did this, apparently, a Japanese scientist, very, very conscientious, very hardworking. He spent every day of a long project getting the gene, cloning it, and then injecting it into the embryos of the mice. And then he went down to check to see if when the mice were born, they were fluorescent green. Okay? He did this once, twice. Apparently, he did it 147 times. And I'm sure that in the lab, his friends in Japan, this was in Osaka, you know, they would have said, what are you doing? How's things going making the green fluorescent mice? And I'm sure they were laughing at him quite a bit. All these repeated experiments, again, he kept having it again and again and again. And then one day, he went down. A mouse had given a litter, he had a look, and they were fluorescent green. And I'd love to have been there to have seen that. And a really good example of someone working very, very hard and getting it to work. So the green fluorescent mouse, we breed these in a colony. We have different types of mouse now where the fluorescent protein is in different cells. And the initial experiments I was involved with involved transplanting cells from the green fluorescent mouse into wild-type mouse. And then we can, of course, track these cells, and we can assess them in the host. The reason we want to do this is we want to see about transplanting cells, if we can follow them and if we can actually identify them. It's easiest to transplant cells at early stages from one mouse to another, and the green fluorescent protein is expressed in high levels in the retina. So this is some early work I was involved with at UCL in London, and this is a transplanted cell. It's been labelled the nucleus with this nuclear label in the donor mouse. Here you can see the transplanted cell sitting in the host mouse retina. This is the outer nuclear layer. If you look very carefully, you can see that this isn't a normal cell. It's a bit bigger than nucleus, and also there's a gap around it here. Okay, so it's abnormally sitting. It's not like the normal cohort of cells. And since then, obviously, we realize that, you know, we're not going to be transplanting cells into a retina that's already got photoreceptors. We're going to be transplanting cells into retina when all the photoreceptors have lost. This shows a scan of the back of the eye. This is the fovea. This is the outer nuclear layer. That's a normal patient. And someone with retinitis pigmentosa, or even in macular degeneration, they've lost all these photoreceptors. So for that reason, we then switched to looking at transplanting cells into the subretinal space when all the photoreceptors have gone. And in that situation, we find that these cells are quite abnormal, as you would expect, in the shape. But nevertheless, in red here, they have outer segments, which is the light-sensing part of the cell, but they don't look like photoreceptors. And as Professor Sahel showed some work doing, again, this is the mouse having an operation with the transplanted cells. and we're trying to find a way of reconstructing the entire outer nuclear layer of photoreceptors from the donor mouse. In fact, when we do this, if we get enough cells in to form these thick clumps, we can actually start to see some photoreceptor morphology. These are some photoreceptors lying on their side in the subretinal space. They're not vertical, they lie on their side. And you can see, there's the nucleus, the fibre, the outer segments. The outer segments in these cells are very short, probably as you would expect, because they're abnormally positioned. But nevertheless, the outer segments are there. And we know from our own experiments and others that these are light-sensitive cells. So in a way, this is similar to the electronic retinal implant. You've got these little dots here, which are the light-sensing parts, and the cells, as long as they're connecting to the host retina, they may send the signals from the light back into the retina. Professor Sahel touched on the concept of getting these cells from skin cells using induced pluripotent stem cells, and we know that it's possible to take a skin cell and convert that into a stem cell. Now, it may be obvious, but everyone here, we've all got the same DNA in all of our cells, okay? Be that a photoreceptor, a skin cell, a cell in your bone, in your blood, the DNA is the same, okay? So what makes one cell a skin cell and another cell a photoreceptor is not what the DNA is in the cells, because it's the same. It's what genes are switched on and what genes are switched off. And the concept of this induced pluripotent stem cell is to try and identify the switches and to switch the genes off that make it a skin cell and switch back on the genes that make it a stem cell. And the pioneering work from Yamanaka's group and others showed that you can do this in two different ways, either using a virus or using plasmids to deliver certain genes that we know can reprogram these histones, which are the proteins that switch the genes on and off in the cell, and that can then switch off the cell-specific genes and switch on the embryonic genes. Okay. Well, that's step one. You then have a stem cell. But of course, what we then want to do is make the photoreceptors to transplant in. And again, following on from Professor Hell's work discussion earlier, we can do this potentially by taking these pluripotent stem cells and differentiating them in vitro using these molecules, which we know work in real life to differentiate photoreceptors in the retina to generate photoreceptor cells. And again, this is work from the Japanese group. So you can see, in theory, that it may be possible to restore sight to a patient who is completely blind using their own cells, perhaps harvested from their blood or from their skin. The cells can be taken from the patient and they can be cloned to make an iPS cell clone of stem cells. These cells can then be differentiated in tissue culture, either using this method with single cells or using the whole iCup method described earlier and developed by Iraku and colleagues. And then these cells can then be transplanted into the subretinal space of a patient who has got retinitis pigmentosa and lost all their cells. We know that the first trial to implant embryonic-derived photoreceptors took place not so long ago, earlier this year. When I was first involved with the photoreceptor transplantation work in 2006, I was asked how long would it take to get into humans, and luckily I said 10 years, because it actually has been 10 years, because of course we're now 10 years ahead from that day. It takes a long time. But once we're into clinical trial, we then learn a lot more about the research, a lot more about what to do to make it work, as we've seen indeed with the gene therapy program. So I would like to put it to you that we have two techniques, two approaches which potentially could cure blindness, and perhaps I could ask the audience for a show of hands. I'm going to ask you to vote on one of these technologies. Do you think that we're going to be restoring vision in 10 years? Do you think we'll be restoring vision with the transplanted cells, the stem cell approach, as I've shown you with the mouse system, the mouse model we're doing in the lab? Or do you think we'll be doing it with the electronic retina? This is one of our other patients reading the clock with his retinal implant. You've got the choice of the embryonic stem cells or the electronic retina. So could I just please then ask for a show of hands? Who would like to vote for the stem cell approach for restoring sight and blindness in 10 years? Okay. And who would now like to vote for the electronic retinal implant? Good. I think I would be on that camp. The reason I should say, of course, is that I said 10 years. You know, if we were talking about 100 years, then I think we'd be talking about stem cells. But there are huge challenges ahead. The electronic retinal implant works well. It needs to be optimized. The vision's not that good, but it does work. Whereas the stem cells, we still need a lot more work to do. So I would like to thank you all for listening to my talk. And also I'd like to acknowledge members of my research team who have produced a lot of the work I've described, and also the funding we have in the UK for the research. Thank you very much indeed.